walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Michelle Raffin, founder and CEO of Pandemonium Aviaries, and the author of The Birds of Pandemonium, Life Among the Exotic and the Endangered, a memoir of sorts that tracks Raffin's path from accidental bird rescuer to internationally prominent expert presiding over a breeding facility for worldwide avian species facing extinction. But it wasn't an easy road to travel, requiring her to negotiate a quirky subculture that isn't big on sharing information and is quite leery of newcomers. It's quite a story, and we'll hear much of it when we speak with Michelle Raffin in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, we'll speak briefly with Darlene Zerner, founder of Darlin's Darlins, a Polk City sanctuary housing some 200 animals, predominantly pigs. They need a new well. 200 animals require a lot of water. And we'll hear about their GoFundMe campaign underway to finance replacing that well. Also, towards the end of the program is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Stratus Center on December 18th. Right now, for our opening animal song, I not only wanted to do a bird song in a nod to Michelle Raffin's passion for feathered friends, but you may know I'm always looking for an excuse to play eels music. These impulses merge seamlessly here. This is Eels with I Like Birds Now on Talking Animals.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds. If you're small and on a search, I've got a feeder for you to perch on. I can't stand in line at the store, the mean little people are such a bore, but it's all right. If you're small and on a search, I've got a feeder for you to perch on.
Music from the Eels with I Like Birds, an animal tune that way may be the guiding philosophy for our guest Michelle Raffin, who runs Pandemonium Aviaries and is the author of the recently published book, The Birds of Pandemonium, Life Among the Exotic and the Endangered. Indeed, let's get to that conversation with her now with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Michelle Raffin to Talking Animals. Good morning, Michelle.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Well, you traveled a long and winding road to arrive at the place where both you and Pandemonium aviaries are considered highly prominent in the avian world, a journey you recount colorfully in the book, The Birds of Pandemonium. And I, of course, want to discuss a lot of that odyssey in a moment or two. But for a few reasons, I'm kind of most interested first in addressing that moment that launched you on the journey some 15 years ago. So set the scene, if you would, of rescuing that injured dove you spotted on the side of the road.
Well, it was indeed a remarkable time for me, but that's really in retrospect. When it happened, I had no idea what would ensue. We have a very busy highway called St. Lawrence Expressway, and I had heard about a hurt bird on the side of the road, and it bothered me that it would just lie there waiting to be run over again. So I went to look for it, and when I found her, it turned out she was indeed injured, and I took her to an avian vet. But the vet told me that my assumption she'd been hit by a car because of her location was wrong, that she'd actually been dropped by a hawk. And that was one of the very first things I learned about birds that I hadn't known before. And as you said, it started a remarkable journey for me.
More than a few, especially for animal lovers, have gone to the aid of an injured bird, and one that's fallen out of its nest or is otherwise hurt or needs help. But looking back, why do you think this was different for you? I mean, why did it nag at you that there was this bird there? And then why rescuing that bird seemed to kind of resonate differently? And as it turns out, obviously served as a sort of catalyst for a string of circumstances that pretty much forever changed your life.
I think that, animals in general have always moved me. And the impulse to help this particular animal was really no different from, helping a lost dog, which I've done in the past. But what was different afterwards was holding that bird when I took her to the vet and then visiting her for the first few days that she was there really changed my opinion of birds. I hadn't known anything about them before. I thought they were sort of pretty and parts of the garden, very self-sufficient. I admired them from a distance, but it never occurred to me that they would have personalities or be very intelligent or really possess most of the endearing qualities that we look for in friends.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I guess with that in mind, I have something that may function as a companion question, because I guess I'm curious, given what you've found, why do you think, relatively speaking, so few people, including people very devoted to animals, seem to care as much about birds? What is it, or what are we missing if we don't find ourselves, even if we are animal people, like I say, responding as strongly to birds?
I think it's really that we just don't know them. They're not domesticated, and even those birds that have been bred to be our pets really retain the wild in them. So unlike the dogs and cats that we grew up with or the horses that we're familiar with, birds, although they are remarkable, are animals that we really don't know very well. And in this case, to know one really is to love one, or at least that's been my experience.
And is it just for those very reasons that a lot of us don't take the extra step or two to find out more or to get to know them? And sort of a related thing to Pandemonium, I think, is that even if people say, well, I would like to find out more about birds, other than some friends that we might have that would have one bird, maybe a couple birds, it's difficult to be exposed to birds and have a chance to say, wow, those are really amazing looking, or wow, that's a great story about how they mate for life, or whatever it might be. Sometimes it's an opportunity issue too, isn't it?
It really is. And I have drawers full of anecdotes that I would write down over my years with birds because I found them so remarkable. And, a good start, of course, is to read a book like The Birds of Pandemonium, because what I included mainly were my bird stories. I found them really remarkable at the time, and I think what has moved me is how deep birds can be, how emotional they can be, and at the end of the day, really how smart. I have dogs and cats. I actually have donkeys and goats too, and birds are way ahead of any of my other animals in understanding and being able to communicate. In general, they're very, very smart.
And even, I guess, now that you say that, sort of more garden variety birds are wildly smart. I mean, I guess it was a couple years ago or so, we had Tony Angel, one of the authors of The Gifts of the Crow, on. And just hearing all about incredibly smart crows and other corvids are, it's revelatory, I think, to a lot of people, including me.
It really is. And there are a lot of birders in the United States, but I think there are more birds watching people than there are birders.
Yeah, it's going the other way. Yeah, yeah.
And if we just spend the time to watch a particular bird, you know, quietly and with concentration, I think that we can observe behaviors that indicate that they are more than just, you know, pretty things in the garden, that they love, they mourn, they mate, they sometimes even murder each other. I mean, they have very complex emotional lives. And, of course, we've learned in the laboratory that birds, especially parrots, have the concept of zero. They make up language. Certainly, many of my birds have made up names for me, and that's kind of humbling at times.
And how, you mean the ones that talk have made up names for you? How do you, okay. So what are some of those names that they've come up with?
Well, one of them, an African gray named Mia Bird, calls me Beep. And the reason she calls me Beep is that when I first got her in, I had a malfunctioning smoke alarm, and I couldn't quite reach it to change the batteries. And so while I was waiting for some help, you know, it was going beep, beep. And she would, because she was new, whenever she called to me, I would come and pay attention to her and talk to her. And it would typically happen when the sound beep happened. So she decided my name was Beep. And to this day, when she wants me, that's what she calls me.
Talk about associating a person with a happenstance or just that sound at that moment. That's and sounds like it's stuck ever since.
Yeah, and there's another name which I actually love. It's a name that no one else calls me. And that is a bird named Shayna called me Pretty Mama. And this happened really over a period of months. This is when we were a rescue and no longer breeders of endangered birds. She had been abandoned by her family of 22 years, and she was in deep mourning. And part of her mourning was that she really didn't want interaction with anyone. I would go up and offer her a treat, and she would turn her back to me. And I didn't really know how to console her. It was in the early days of being a rescue. And I did the only thing I could, which was to imitate her former owner's tone of voice and to say what she had said, which was, "Pretty bird. Shayna, you're a pretty bird." And Shayna, for months, just didn't respond. And I was almost about to give up, and I was so sad that she was having such a tough time. And one morning, I went to her, and I had a treat for her, and I said, "Shayna, you're such a pretty bird." And she turned around, looked at me, said, "Pretty mama," called up my arm, and since then, she's become my darling, and actually, she is, we call her a diva because she pretty much runs the parrot area.
Those moments are so powerful, and yeah, you describe a number of them in the book. Let me let folks know who might just be tuning in now. My guest is Michelle Raffin, CEO of Pandemonium Aviaries and author of The Birds of Pandemonium, Life Among the Exotic and the Endangered. If you'd like to ask Michelle a question about birds of one kind or another or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Michelle, the book is peopled with all sorts of wonderful eccentrics. I mean, there's certainly wonderful eccentrics of the bird persuasion, and sometimes not so wonderful eccentrics of the human persuasion. You describe a real quirky, colorful subculture where generally its denizens aren't keen to share information, at least initially, and similarly aren't all that keen on newcomers, especially, I guess, very, very leery of female newcomers. Can you talk about what it was like for you navigating that territory, at least in the early years?
Well, there is a subculture of bird breeders, and for the most part, they're really wonderful people. But like other groups, they tend to be fairly inbred, and they've developed friendships that have been built over many decades. Rare birds are held in held back from the public, and they're traded back and forth. And they're traded based on chits that have developed over many, many years. So if you gave me a bird that I needed 20 years ago, and I have a bird that you need today, even if I've already sold that bird or promised that bird to someone else, I will say, "Oh, sorry, you know, no longer have the bird, and I will give it to you." It's a wonderful reservoir of knowledge. These breeders, a few of them are women, but most of them are men, have accumulated just huge reservoirs of what it takes to keep and breed birds. But unfortunately, they don't write it down. And so as they die down or leave the business, and it is a rapidly aging group, all that information is being lost. And we at Pandemonium, you know, have a program to raise the funds to really document what these bird breeders have discovered so that we can use that knowledge going forward.
That's going to be really valuable, especially because, as you described, it's otherwise kind of lost without doing that. But it certainly it seems like, at least in your earliest kind of forays into that world, there was also just sort of a personal, I guess, tendency just to not want to share the information, whether they had it written down or not. It was just like, hey, who are you? And I just do what I do over here, and I'm not inclined to discuss what that is or share information.
I think that's correct. I had to earn my way into the group, and it took many, many years, and actually it took breeding a rare bird that none of them had been able to breed to finally get my badge of honor and be allowed into the old boys club.
Yeah, and then you were like, okay, this Michelle's okay after all. Yeah.
Yes, and it's also a world in which people are very focused, and in some cases really almost eccentrically passionate about what they do. It's not unlike the people who collect rare orchids or who, have other activities that the normal population is just not that incredibly interested in. These people are really passionately interested in. And since birds are disappearing at a very large, it's birds in the wild are disappearing and birds in captivity are disappearing as well, that in order to get a partner for one of the species that you may carry is difficult, and it requires a lot of work. And so any newcomer coming into this business is viewed as a little bit of a threat. I now count many of these breeders as my friends, and I respect a lot what they do, but the early years were not easy.
And also I think another part of that, too, that you make clear in the book is that for a lot of these folks, and of course for you as well, related to being very passionate and consumed with it, it's a huge ongoing job. And so it seems like even if people were friendly or at least friendlier initially to newcomers, that's less the point in some cases than they just seem to be working virtually around the clock.
Absolutely. It is very hard work. I mean, your animals are, you have to take care of them every single day, regardless of weather. Very few bird breeders will take a vacation. I know for myself, it's very hard to get away. You get to know your birds, and you get to know just a slight sign that something might be off so that you can intervene in time. Birds are prey animals for the most part, and they don't show any illness until they're really, really sick and it's hard to save them. So it is, they're like farmers. They're like very good farmers. They are tied to the land. They're tied to their profession, and they're tied to their birds.
Yeah. Well, you brought up something I was going to sort of get into a bit later, but this is as good a time as any, because sort of an informal through line of the book is sort of what's stated and unstated about when you are away from Pandemonium. The gravity of your absence runs the gamut from just missing out on the daily dance parties that you described that you and a lot of the birds have, to some birds being really profoundly angry when you're away. And then the thing you also just alluded to, that probably no one has the kind of eye and expertise there that you do. So if one of the birds is not doing well or just seems to be a little off, very hard probably to spot if it wasn't you there to spot it. So
that's correct. And 6 years ago, I transitioned from being a rescue, and we no longer take in rescued birds, to being a breeder of endangered species. And that happened because of the death of one of our birds. She was a green-necked pheasant pigeon. She'd been on the nest, and I had been away, and she died. And what happened was her mate started to cry. And he cried day and night. The sound of a green-necked pheasant pigeon's call is really haunting. It's a high-pitched whistle that kind of descends. And he just sat, wouldn't eat very much, and just cried. And after I returned in several days of listening to this, I decided that even though the birds I had gotten up until then were birds that had been given to me or at shelters had brought over, that I needed to go buy a mate for him. I needed to replace, his lost love. And when I went in search, and I called all the, everybody I knew, what I found out was that in the entire world, there were only 32 green-necked pheasant pigeons left in captivity. And that in the 10 years since I'd been doing rescue, the world of birds had really changed, and that if I wanted to make a contribution, it had to be more than just saving individual birds. It had to be saving species. So I really, it was the search for green-necked pheasant pigeon that drove our change. I'm happy to say that I did eventually find a mate for him, and Pandemonium now has more green-necked pheasant pigeons than any institution in the world. We certainly outrank all of the zoos, and that's really what we're known for, is breeding green-necked pheasant pigeons.
There's a few things there in your answer that I'd like to sort of follow up on. One is that I was really struck in this story you just said, but in some other cases too, about the tight bond in some species, at least, between males and females, and what happens if one of them is removed accidentally. Like early on in your years, there was something where one of those other breeder bird people who was sort of friendly to you at first, there was, I think, a mix-up, and the male and the female of a couple got separated unwittingly, and there was pretty awful consequences and the thing you just described. So how widespread among the species that you do work with is that sort of bond, and the implications of if that bond is broken?
Well, as you mentioned, it does vary between species, but for me, it brings up the even greater question of really culture. You know, do animals have culture? And what I've observed in birds is that they really do. They really do have, ways of relating to each other that indicate, in some cases also, very strong family bonds. Now, there have been some experiments done in a small Mexican parrot which demonstrates that their babies learn not only their own names in the nest before they fledge, but they learn each other's names, their siblings' names, and they learn their parents' names. And so there is really communication and language in family groups, and I believe between family groups as well. And to me, that's the beginning, really. That's one of the indications of culture.
Yeah, it's really the social complexity, the communication, the grieving, and other things that go on really does bespeak not only culture, but I think, again, for a lot of people who just haven't been steeped in the bird world, just a much more complex world and functioning animal than they might otherwise have thought.
I think that's correct. And one of the joys for me, as well as one of the difficulties, is learning about this, because there's really not a lot that's been written. And it has come from really direct observation and just spending time and watching. I think birds are pretty remarkable in their desire to communicate with us. At least that's been my experience. And we at Kent Pandemonium do not have social interaction with our endangered birds, because we're breeding them to release them back to the wild. So we really don't want them to get to know people and not to fear them. Careful in the way the aviaries are set up and how we interact. But every so often, I will need to go into an aviary, and it's remarkable to me that some birds that I don't have a relationship with can really tell me what's wrong. You know, they will act in a way that will indicate. In one case, a water dish had been overturned and there was no water. And the bird kept, as soon as I walked in, kept repeatedly going over to the water dish as if to say, hey, I need some water.
Get with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was another time when a pair of Victoria Crown pigeons were trying to build a nest, and we had inadvertently put sticks that were too big for it. So as soon as I walked in, this bird took a stick and hit it against the ground and hit it against the ground and looked at me. Like, you know, hey, you fool, this is too big. I can't break it. I need something smaller. And even though it was a wild bird, I was able to approach close enough to pick up the stick and to break it. And the bird immediately took the smaller piece and took it to the nest, picked up a large piece, looked at me and said, okay, this one's next. And this has happened repeatedly over my many years with birds.
I hope that bird wrote you a thank you note after helping him with the stick.
No, not even my children write thank you notes.
So, Michelle, yeah, I have a bunch of questions sort of related to the breeding and sort of other related issues, but let me take one of our callers who's been holding for quite some time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michelle Reffin.
Hi, my name is Mason, and I just came in from Vermont, and friend of my daughter's was out deer hunting in the woods in the snow and stuff, and a partridge landed on his rifle, and he had a smartphone with him, and then it crawled up his arm and sat on his shoulder for 10 minutes, and he's got the whole thing on video. It's just amazing.
And then what happened after that? Did the bird just...
I'm not sure.
Okay.
You know, I didn't talk to the lad, but... years ago at the marina, we were listening to Jimmy Buffett on a big cruise ship radio, and this male cardinal whistled right along with the Wasted Away in Margaritaville.
That's wonderful.
I think it must have been the steel drums that he was answering.
Well, also clearly a parrot head, right? Yeah.
That's great.
Okay, well, those are some great stories. Thank you for your call, sir. In fact, I should quickly say before we move on that beyond how most of us understand the meaning of the word pandemonium, it also is a term for a group of parrots, a pandemonium of parrots, hence the aviary's name. So that's at least some little tidbit you can take away from today's show. So this is Talking Animals. I'm speaking with Michelle Raffin, CEO of Pandemonium Aviaries, and whose recent book is The Birds of Pandemonium, Life Among the Exotic and the Endangered. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Michelle, I want to spend some time on what pandemonium aviaries means in terms of conservation and breeding. One of the things that's most striking to me about pandemonium is that it operates on the positive side of breeding and the legitimate, authentic side of conservation, a term that, as we've discussed many times on the show, is often co-opted by organizations, including many zoos, even Ringling and some other circuses, in ways that are pretty nefarious and frankly, just sort of baloney. But in your case, you are clearly, again, a lot of sanctuaries and facilities, if they're breeding, it's usually a red flag. But pandemonium is on the other side of that, because you really are pursuing conservation efforts, and you really are engaged in breeding of species that are otherwise on the brink of extinction. So maybe you could talk more sort of about your efforts there and the specific birds and species that are at risk that you're really trying to bring back and send out.
Well, the birds that we breed are from the island of New Guinea, a couple of species from the Philippines. And let me just back up by saying it's always better to do conservation breeding in the country itself. You know, if you have a bird that is going extinct and you want to save it, it's so much better to set up a conservation breeding effort right there where the bird lives. You can get the local foods and, you can release the birds afterwards. Unfortunately, that's very difficult to do in New Guinea nowadays. You know, hopefully things will change over the years, but right now there are very few conservation groups for a variety of reasons. And there are at the same time huge biodiversity and some very, very important species. So we are doing the breeding out of country. We're doing it in the United States. And we're doing it in a somewhat unusual way, but one that really could be a model for a lot of other species. And that is that we are taking birds that were either imported years ago or their offspring, and we're taking them from zoos, we're taking them as from pets, we're taking them from breeders. Actually, when I say taking, we're buying. And we're trying to, instead of keeping them as pets or tame, we try to remind them that they're birds. We give them situations, certainly with mates and the great food and, wonderful quarters, so that they can reproduce, and we don't sell offspring. We keep them. So we get no income at all from what our birds, produce. We keep them because our thoughts are that, should the birds go extinct in New Guinea, the ones that we're trying to save, then we want to have a reservoir of diverse genetic flocks that could be used to reintroduce to the wild. And, of course, the larger the number you have and the more diverse genetically, the more, chances of success you have in terms of having a viable, wild population. And so that is what, we often get requests to sell our birds, and the answer is always unequivocally no. We want to build up a reservoir of probably 100 breeding pairs.
So, Michelle, in the meantime, while building and maintaining that reservoir, are some of those birds periodically reintroduced to the wild now, or is the whole idea just to sort of keep preparing that reservoir and just being ready for when their things have just reached that point there where they absolutely need to come from Pandemonium?
That's a really good question. We were doing the latter. We function as a Noah's Ark in a way. If it were safe for the birds in their own homeland right now, we would be releasing them. Although, as you know, that's a very difficult process, and Pandemonium would not be the organization, you know, doing the species reintroduction. Those require skills that are very unique and not ones which we possess. But the idea is that the conditions have to be safe for them and before we would reintroduce them to the wild. Right now, one of the issues in New Guinea is that there are no land rights. So you can't really have a protected reserve. You can't have places like you have in Africa where you have animals that, you know, are not hunted and they're basically protected. And that would be a number one step. We would need to, you know, have protected land so that the same conditions that are really creating damage to the species right now, you know, would not, you know, be existing there and harm our birds. One of the big threats is hunting. And now that the, you know, there are big companies, oil companies, mining companies, that are building roads through the forest in New Guinea, and there's easier access for the hunters to reach populations of these birds that they weren't able to get before. And so until that changes, we will keep the birds safe in captivity.
I gotcha. Okay, well, let's take another one of our callers. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michelle Raffin.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for what you do. And secondly, just want to mention that I took in a lovebird a number of years ago who did end up being the love of my life because he was so highly socialized, and I was able to take him wherever I went and worked mostly at home. Anyhow, my question comes to every bird rescue and sanctuary that I know is full to capacity and beyond. And it's just, I mean, I'm sorry, I understand breeding for conservation, but I hear breeding in terms of pet birds and it gives me a pain every time. Because I know how many of those animals are going to die just because people don't understand the responsibility they're taking on. So I think that any response to that in terms of strategies that or ways that the public can be educated to realize this?
I think you bring up really excellent points and several of them. And you're right, the rescues in the sanctuaries really are full. And that's because I think that there is a general lack of understanding of the great responsibility, the amount of work, and really how long-term it is to bring a bird into your life. I mean, some of these birds live a very long time. They oftentimes will outlive their human family. You know, there are parrots that live to be 60, 80 years old. That's a really long time. That's good news. I mean, you get to keep them for a while, and you know, and it's bad news because they will probably still be around, and you need to provide for them in your will. So I agree as well that the lack of knowledge in general about what it takes to care for these birds ends up being giving some of these birds unhappy endings. Because they do end up being sent from home to home to home. They have to readjust each time. So there are huge difficulties. That being said, there really are some very responsible and knowledgeable and reputable breeders, and they do educate the people that they sell to, and then they also take back birds if people no longer want them. So I don't want to lump the whole, you know, area of bird breeding as being bad. I do think that, you know, birds belong out flying in the wild. I think that most of these bird species do not belong as our pets in our homes. It is, they have requirements that are sometimes incompatible with ours. You know, we can get our dogs and cats to eat out of the dishes that we want, when we want. They can go to the bathroom where we tell them. They learn to live in our homes. And that, you know, in most cases makes them good citizens, and we keep them for their entire lives. However, with birds still have the wild in them. They will yell, you know, in the morning and night. To us, it sounds like yelling. But in fact, for them, it's their natural calling that in the wild, the flocks would be reassembling, and they would be saying hi to each other, and how was your day, and I'm back, and where are you? So it's a complicated issue. You know, how do we keep some of these birds alive and keep the genetic strains alive while they are disappearing in the wild? And yet, how do we protect individual birds from suffering at the hands of owners that don't understand that these are animals that need to be part of our families? If we do have a bird, we can't just leave it in a cage and ignore it. You know, we have to have, you know, lots of out time, lots of play time, lots of socialization time, lots of really good, not lots, because sometimes they're overfed, but really good nutritious food, not just seed dumped into a dish. They require the care and maintenance of a 3 to 4 year old toddler, and that is a lot of work.
Thank you so much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, so that's, I think, what I was sort of alluding to a bit ago when I was talking about the conservation and breeding, and that it's jarring if you're steeped in the animal world and animal sanctuaries and comparable facilities, which, at least the legitimate ones, breeding is an absolute no-no. But this is, as you really explained, I think, quite well in response to that caller, this is a very different set of circumstances and with a very specific purpose in mind, as opposed to, let's say, a worst case scenario, you know, people just trying to get more tiger cubs to be pet and make their money with that. So
and you see, I think what a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, I think zoos, obviously, if you work in a zoo, you run a zoo, you love animals. That's why you're in that business. But your business really is, in a certain sense, entertainment. It's showing people these animals. And it is not a good business move for places like this to reserve space to conserve animals, because in order to breed, they can't really be on display, and they're taking up space that does not lead to a public being interested in your zoo. So it's very hard for zoos to do the type of work that they do. Breeders find it very difficult too. I mean, they don't make a lot of money. They, you know, I write for a conservation organization. I write also for the Aviculture Society of America, which is the Association of Breeders. You know, and every article I urge, you know, my breeders to save 10% of your space and your resources and just breed very endangered birds that you do not sell. You don't make any money from them. You're just doing it as a give back to the bird world. But it's hard for them. Most of them can't afford to do that. So, you know, we're very careful. We only have 6 species that we're breeding. These are species that have been designated as really important, and frankly, no one else is doing the work. So if we didn't, I don't know what hope these species would have if bad things happened to them in the wild.
And sort of, I guess, possibly on a related note, and to respond to one of our emailers, it says here, great guest, I know zero about birds, but thanks to this interview, I will start paying a lot more attention. Then they ask, when you release your exotic endangered birds, do they naturally pick up migrating patterns? Now, I don't know, we've established at least the ones in New Guinea so far are not being released, but are just sort of being preserved in the reservoir situation.
Yeah.
Have there been some pandemonium birds that have been released?
They have not. Our birds are non-migratory.
Okay.
But there is a success story in conservation in the United States, actually. And that's the Puerto Rican Amazon parrot. The Puerto Rican Amazon parrot is the only parrot that's really endemic to the United States. And it was down to, you know, maybe 12 individuals. It was taken into captivity and conservation breeding was done. And then, you know, as the populations built up, the birds started to be re-released. And there are now several hundred flying free on the island of Puerto Rico. And we would be partnering with an organization like that to do the actual release. There's a lot involved. Among the things you want to make sure of is that your animals that you're releasing do not have pathogens or types of bacteria that could hurt whatever remaining flocks there are. You know, you don't want to spread disease either way. And so that requires, you know, a lot of expertise to prevent. You also need to teach the birds how to find food. And so you don't just open a cage and let them go. It's, I think the other thing is the question about migrating, and you know, a lot of it is taught. Some of it is intuitive, and we know so little about most of the natural world. And one of the things we are trying to figure out is how do birds migrate? You know, how do they figure it out? And it's actually what we're finding, it's pretty complex. So some species need to be taught by their parents. They need to follow their parents on a migration. Luckily, the 6 species that we're breeding do not migrate. It's not an issue we have to deal with. but certainly one of the things to think about in conservation breeding if you are breeding birds that are migratory.
For sure. Well, gosh, Michelle, it's been really great, and we've already learned, I think, yet a lot more just in this conversation. We're speaking with Michelle Raffin from Pandemonium Aviaries. The new book that she's written is The Birds of Pandemonium, Life Among the Exotic and the Endangered. The website is pandemoniumaviaries.org, and chock full of information, much of which we've discussed, a lot of other stuff we didn't have time to discuss, as well as some nice cameras there where you can actually see a lot of these birds in action at the Pandemonium. So, Michelle, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
In a moment, we'll have a brief chat with Darlene Zerner of Darlin's Darlins about the Sanctuary GoFundMe campaign to replace their well so as to better provide water for the 200 or so animals living there. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. Got birds on my mind. It's hard not to after that conversation with Michelle Raff. So this is a vintage piece from Ellen DeGeneres called Birds Mating on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
This is a weird mating habit. I learned this playing Trivial Pursuit, which is a game that I absolutely hate. I don't know if you hate the game as much. I think stupid people, don't clap, stupid people hate it the most, because you're just... trying to save you. Because you're just sitting there, you wait, because you're just waiting for it to be your turn so you can say, I don't know. Danny Kaye, I don't know. You're just guessing anything. I get the question, what is the only animal that mates while going 80 miles an hour? And it is? No? Eagle, the eagle. Yeah, good guesses, though, but thanks for playing. It's, Danny Kaye was a bad guess, I realize that now. I had read that somewhere, but it wasn't true. It's the eagle, and this is what they do. This is really how they mate. The male and the female golden eagle both go 3 to 4 miles high. They start going 80 miles an hour, which is incredibly fast, and then they connect. I don't know either. And then they start dropping, and they don't stop dropping until the act is completed. So it's not uncommon that they both fall all the way to the ground, hit the ground, both of them die. That's how committed they are to this. I don't know about you, but if I'm one of these two birds, you're getting close to the ground, I would seriously consider faking it.
Little phone difficulty with Darlin, but I think we've got it worked out. So to get a bit caught up, first of all, that was Ellen DeGeneres, by the way, with a piece called Birds Mating, taken from her album titled Taste This. But right now, to get a bit caught up with Darlin's Darlins and the Sanctuary's GoFundMe campaign to replace their well, a significant component in caring for 200 animals, let's welcome Darlin Zerner back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Darlin.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us again on Talk Animals. Of course, we did do an extended, detailed interview about 2 years ago, but for those not familiar, give us the quick nickel tour of Darlin's Darlins. What is it? What is its mission? And so on.
Tour is Darlin's Darlins is basically a farm animal rescue sanctuary. It was founded back in 2001 as a potbelly pig sanctuary, but as we grew, we realized that all animals are pretty much the same, and so as they come to us, we take them in and take care of them, provide them life sanctuary if necessary. If we can adopt them out, that's great, but that doesn't usually happen, unfortunately.
So how many are living there then?
Oh, my goodness. Must be... We've got 167 pigs and of various kinds, feral farm and potbelly, and we've got a dozen dogs and 3 or 4 dozen cats and a cow and a thoroughbred that they were going to put down. So we have a pretty full house.
With that in mind, as we've sort of alluded to and we're sort of tipping our hand here, I guess, you need a lot of water for all those animals of one kind or another. So tell us what's going on with the sanctuary's current well and what you're hoping to do about it.
Well, when our house burned down back in 2008, we bought this property up in Polk City. And, of course, we bought it for the property for the animals, not so much for the house. But it had a 2-inch well, which is not a very big well for 200 animals in a house. About a year ago, it began to take on sand, and the water would come out kind of milky-looking from the silt. And so we started a fundraiser. It's been over a year that we've been trying to raise the money for the well. We really need a 4-inch well to order to water this many animals. I mean, my goodness. We've collected some of it, but it's been pretty slow going. And then yesterday we were out watering and we noticed the silt is back again. It comes and goes. It was really bad for a while and then it cleared up and now it's back again.
So clearly you need a new well.
Oh, clearly I need it.
Well, so let's just in our remaining moment or so here, darling. So, this time of year, there are people sometimes looking around for, it's the holidays, looking for things to contribute to, nonprofits, projects, et cetera, to support. So if someone said, hey, you know what, I'd like to help them their well or their campaign to get a well, what would be the step someone would take?
Well, they could visit the website at darlinsdarlins.org, and there's a PayPal link there. They can go to GoFundMe, Darlins Darlins Rescue Ranch, and that's R-E-S Big Q Ranch. And then there's the PayPal account that's Darlins Darlins Rescue Ranch as well.
So there's a few different ways to get there, but any number of ways ultimately give you that chance to throw a few bucks in the well kitty, as it were.
Yeah, that would be just great.
Well, again, those animals, they're not going to put up too much longer probably with water that's, might have some sand or silt or something in it. Sounds like the sooner the better for the new well.
Oh, yeah. I've talked to Tim Fussell, who is going to do the well for us, and he's going to come out and spot it so that we can at least start figuring out where it's going to go.
Oh, great. Well, that's promising. At least you're taking steps to make this a reality even before the money's in hand. But as soon as it is, then it sounds like you'll be ready to go.
Right.
Great, darling. Well, good luck on that. And thanks for all your efforts helping all those animals. A lot of pigs and a lot of other nice animals there, too. So let's hope that well comes quickly.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Duncan. I really appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care now, darling.
Happy holidays to everybody.
All right. You too. Thanks. This is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Stroud Center on December 18th. We'll get to that in a moment here on Talking Animals. Right now, a couple of quick animal news and announcements, including the Tampa Bay Cat Alliance is holding its fourth annual charity auction fundraiser this Saturday, December 6th, at the Countryside Country Club in Clearwater. From 11:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., there's a chef's table, all kinds of cash bar, raffle tickets, gift baskets, etc. For tickets, you can call 727-857-7801, or you can just simply go to TampaBayCatAlliance.org for more information or to purchase your tickets. Also, our friends at the Animal-Based Charities have got another Petapalooza coming up. This one's in Sanford. It's December 13th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Seminole State College on Weldon Boulevard in Sanford. So again, a big family, pet-friendly event, adoptables, activities, photos, music, all kinds of stuff. So you can go to Animal-Based Charities to find out more about that. Those are the only ones that are pressing for the moment. We'll get into more next week. Right now, though, it's time to play Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from us in the last 90 days. There will be a prize, a pair of tickets to see jazz musician Gregory Porter performing at the Stroud Center on December 18th. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this, yes, bird-oriented animal tune. But again, please only call in with a guest if you can attend the Gregory Porter Show December 18th at the Stras. It's Named an Animal Tune on Talking Animals. We'll take any guesses off the air that come in. We have just about reached today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition. Please go to talkinganimals.net for all kinds of information, links to our Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. Archives and podcasts of all the shows we've done over all these many years, all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Truss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is WMNF. Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Wiggy-Watchy, and Beyond Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.